Gentlemen, I'm Christopher Johnson. I'm a representative of the Robbins family, and it was, of course, to commemorate Lionel Robbins that these lectures were inaugurated over 10 years ago. And we've been very lucky in the lecturers we've had, particularly, I think, in Richard Freeman. I would advise any of you who missed yesterday's lecture to stay for the questions, because they fizz just as much as the lecture itself. Yesterday, Professor Freeman talked to us about caring. It's very topical because, of course, there's a government report out today on caring for the elderly, which the main upshot seems to be the government doesn't want to pay for it. You might comment on that later, but today's lecture is actually about sharing, and I'm very glad to see here, in addition to the LSE faculty and students, an old friend of mine who has been developing co-ops and job ownership for many years, and I hope one or two other people like that who will ask questions from their own experience. Richard, the floor is yours.
I want to talk about two aspects of really the distribution of income and the distribution of decision-making power in a society. Most of the talk will be about the decision and financial sharing inside firms. But there's a second component we have to worry about as well. And you think about economies as having two distributional problems. To maximize production, to be efficient, what we want to do is to make sure that the person who makes the decision is the person who has the correct information. That usually means devolving authority inside any organization. The head of the LSE does not ask what different professors are teaching in their classrooms. He doesn't have the information to do that. The head of IBM, I don't know him, but my guess would be, does not know how to write a computer program, may not know how to operate a computer. I'm sure he has a very fancy one on his desk. And probably asks his son or daughter to get them connected up to the internet. That'd be my guess. That is probably true of the heads of major organizations. So you, for efficiency, you want the decisions to be made by the individuals who have the correct knowledge. The problem facing a firm is the following. If I give you or allocate decision-making power to you, you suddenly have some power. You are making key decisions. That gives you some bargaining power in the distribution of the outcomes of the firm, the output of the firm. Now, ideally, I would like to set up a contract with you, and although there's a huge literature, as many of you undoubtedly know, of optimal incentives, all of which are based on what is the maximizing contract, what's the best contract the firm can give people so that it maximizes shareholder value. And that's one way of thinking of this problem. But in fact, as they give more power, suddenly the workers may sit there and say, wait a second, that's a great contract from your point of view. I want that contract changed. And so there's going to be an intrinsic conflict between the optimal incentive to the people and the what may be the most efficient point. And that's what I'll talk about for the most part today. The other issue is, even if every organization resolves this problem perfectly, there are still some people who are left out of the system. And the question becomes, how do we allocate resources, and the elderly, which you mentioned, to people who are not productive, either because they're retired, because they're injured, because they lack certain skills? That's another part of distribution. I'll talk a little bit about that. But mostly I want to talk about distribution within the distribution and efficiency within the public within the productive sector. This graph is the way I think about this problem. And basically, this is going to be the organization of the whole of all the information will be associated with this graph. And what does this graph do for us? Or what does it say? It's a curve that's supposed to represent the extra value I get in production from, in fact, allocating decisions to workers, to people below me. I'm the CEO of the company. Or that the shareholders get from allocating decisions to the management, etc. It, along this axis, is the share in decision making of the workers. Along this axis is the added value. And as a good economist, I wrote a curve that goes up and comes down. And because it comes up and comes down, it has an optimum. And that optimum is right here. Now think about the decision faced by the firm or by the workers as separate groups. And these are the various points. Here is, we give a certain amount of authority, power to workers. They make decisions, and we get the optimal amount of production. That's the efficient point. But I, as an owner of this firm, that's not what my goal is. My goal is to maximize the returns that come to me as the owner. And what I will do will be, what I've scaled this as is that V is the share of the rewards, of the profits that go to the workers. And for simplicity, think about that also as the share of decision making. There needn't be a one-to-one transformation, but that just eases the analysis. We could have a more complicated analysis. So what I get is 1 minus V R of V. I get, this is the firm's share of the extra value created from allocating some decision making or giving the workers a share of profits. I want to maximize this. I don't want to maximize this. I want to maximize the part that comes to me. I do not value the part that goes to you, if you're the worker. So that turns out that maximan says I'm going to give you less power, less authority than I optimally should. Because the way this is set up, as I give you more and more power, my share is going down, V is going up. It's true you're creating extra value, but I'm not getting it. And indeed, after this point, my income falls. Now you can turn that around and do the exact same argument for the workers' side. And if the workers are sitting there saying, gee, what do we want to do? Well, we want to have some power to take shares of the profits, but we also will behave just like the management. We will want more power, a bigger share. And that's the concern people often have with certain kinds of worker-owned operations, that they will take too much from capital so that the operation is no longer as efficient as it could be. Well, this is the way I want to think about this whole sharing problem. We want to share, if we can, to the optimal point, and that way we get maximum production. But the incentive to the firm and to workers who don't own the firm is that they will want more of this thing, and they will not do the optimal sharing relation. So that's the problem. Now we have various sets of institutions and various sets of compensation that people have devised to try to deal with this problem. Say most of this is seen from the firm's view with the optimal incentives. How can I give or the shareholders' view, how do I give an incentive to people so that they will behave the way I'd like them to behave and maximize the value of the firm? What I put on two is dividing up these institutions that we have for sharing. We have sharing in decision making only. And I think of German workers on the boards. They vote, they can have some say on the corporate boards, but they don't own a thing. Makes them a little peculiar to be voting, and of course the Germans make sure that the management has the majority vote on this. In the United States, to a lesser extent in the United Kingdom, we have a lot of employee involvement committees in which management says to the workers, point blank, I cannot make the decision. You guys make the decisions in this local area. I call the production decisions. That's largely what they're about. They're saying, well, you guys decide how best to produce the good in your terrain. And then we have works councils, which here I put employee local decisions, because a lot of what European works councils deal with are employee relations, grievances, problems of that kind. All of these you share in decision making. You don't necessarily share in rewards. And of course, that an economist looks at that and says, there may be an incentive problem here. You're giving people some decision authority, but you're not necessarily giving them the incentive to behave optimally. Now we have a set of things where you share in financial rewards only. General Pension Fund. Peter Drucker pointed out in 1976, I think, that a large fraction of the American capitalist system was owned by pension funds. And that's still true today, a very large fraction. And it'll be growing, I think, in all the countries as private pensions become more and more important. But that's a sharing in financial things. I have a pension fund that owns shares and I don't even know what, and I don't pay any attention. It's a mutual fund of some sort by the university, run for university professors. It owns things. But I have no say in any decision making, and that's what the pension fund does. But I do have a sharing in the financial thing. If the stock market goes up, you'd be amazed at how many of my colleagues, all of whom, every professor in the U.S. has shares in this, because that is the pension plan for the university people. And you'd be amazed at how many people who used to be very left-wing, as they get on in years and notice the boom in the stock market, they really feel good. And it has a significant effect in changing people's attitudes. There are pension funds in one's own company. And there are a chunk of pension funds set up, so it is in the U.S., some of these, what they call 401ks, do this. I'll give you some numbers in a minute so you get a flavor as to how widespread these things are. But you can have a pension fund in your own company, but you can't, maybe you don't vote the shares. That is almost always the case if it's a defined benefit pension plan. The company has promised you some retirement. They decide to fund this partly by buying shares of their own firm, and they vote the shares and they decide what to do because they bear the risk. They have to pay you the money even if the company does very poorly. So they'd have to sell other assets or do something. That's a strong liability. Then we have what is one of the newest things on the block, all employee stock options, which are the fastest growing form of compensation. As far as I can see, probably in the capitalist world. And that, ASDA here is a case of doing this. Starbucks does this. And I put it here as sharing in financial only. What it means is, the employee comes, you come to ASDA, and if you work for, I don't know, 6 months or a year or 2 years, whatever the period is, you then get, a couple of years down the road, a stock option, as if you were an executive. And if the share price goes up of that company, bingo, you make a chunk of money. Because then you can exercise that, they give it to you on this day at $10. If the price goes up to 12, bingo, when you have that right to exercise it, sell it at 12. or you could hold it and you do, decide what you want to do. This is growing incredibly rapidly. I say sharing in financial only because I can't imagine how, as the clerk or somebody who runs the Starbucks coffee thing, can in fact affect the share price of the company through their decisions. There are hundreds of stores, and I work very hard to raise the share price in my store, but this guy over here, he's just a grumpy guy to the customers, and the share price goes down, and we it's the one over N problem of there are just too many. It's company-wide profit sharing, which is also very widespread, the same issue. These are financial things only. Although we'll see, companies don't put this in just to get financial things. They obviously want some output. And then finally, various forms in which you share in both finance and decision-making. Now, lest anybody think that sharing in finance and decision-making is the best thing in the world, piece rate pay is basically that. You share in the finance, the more pieces you produce, the more money you get. As you may or may not know, the country that went down the furthest along a piece rate route was the old Soviet Union. And piece rates have been in decline in the West probably for 100 years. So something about this doesn't work. It doesn't give the right incentives to people. You could think of the kind of thing that might occur. I figure out a really fast way to produce the good. I'm not going to tell anybody else in the shop. So the information is very localized. Why? Because if everybody produces it really fast, the firm is going to lower the piece. They're going to say, we're really getting an awful lot of production here. We'll lower it. Then there's various forms of gain sharing. There's various forms of group profit sharing, which are, I put them as a mixture because they of finance and decision making, because they're based on your local production. If this Starbucks store sells more pounds of coffee and the store makes more money, the workers get something. And there, if you go to the local Starbucks, you see, there are only a few workers there. There's a turnover, but maybe they have 15 employees who come in at various times during the week. And you could now see, well, that's a small enough number that you could see people thinking, well, yeah, we ought to push to produce more or to be pleasant to the customers or whatever. And then finally, we come to employee ownership and partnerships. And of course, one of the most successful companies in the world, which is again thinking of going to go public and give up its thing, partnership, is Goldman Sachs. That is a partnership. And they have done extremely well in their business. And each time, I must say, which is a warning to everybody, the last time they were going to sell on the public the stock, the market went way, way down. And they are currently planning to sell again in May. So, you've heard, there's a chance that the market will go down again if we follow that correlation. And then there is employee ownership, which has been growing to a certain extent in the U.S. and the U.K. There are a set of institutions there. Now what we want to know about these institutions, well, first I want to give you some idea of their magnitudes. And mostly I'll refer to the U.S. simply because, that's where the bulk of my information comes. And take the first one. Oh, you're going to lift it up? Thanks. I was going to bend down and do it. Thanks. It is striking, in the United States, where private sector unionism is really declining, unions today represent twice as many people through the pension plan as they represent in the workforce. This is only the private sector unions. Public sector unions also have pension funds that own private shares. So it is an incredible thing that in America, the unions are bigger players in the capital market than they are in the labor market. And they've got, the AFL-CIO has set up a think tank now, or a group that's supposed to be thinking about how can they exercise their capital market power. They own a large share of, through their pension plans. They're subject to fiduciary responsibility, so that you have to act in the interests of the pensioners or the potential pensioners. Very rapidly growing in the U.S. are 401k plans. There are certain tax things you get. 23 million people. Of those, 7 million have a lot stock in their own company. Estimated 2 million, it's almost all in your own company. That's a big ownership thing. We have about 7.7 million people in ESOPs. We have other forms of employee ownership around 7 million, according to the latest estimates. We currently have 5 million people in these plans like the ASDA plan, an all-employee stock ownership plan. So I just summed all these things up, and it's around 17 million people in the U.S. I don't know quite what the numbers would be in the U.K. My guess is they'd be smaller, proportionately. 17 million people, and then you go and you look at the union membership, it's, you know, half as much. So more people, it's striking, have a stake in their company through some ownership than have a stake in the company through collective bargaining, which is another way of getting your share of the pie, obviously. And then we currently have in the U.S. around 22 million people who work in employee involvement committees. Obviously, there'll be some overlap of these two, so you can't add them up. But you're clearly talking about something that is, my guess would be, covers about 30% of the workforce, are in a very different relation to the enterprise and the capitalism than, you know, Marx or someone would have recognized. And now the latest, there was just a recent survey by Arthur Anderson, which said that of the major multinationals in the world, now 27% of them have some form of stock ownership plan for their workers. So this is a significant component, firms going down this route. Hey, look, this is some evidence of the growth of these things. And they're taken from different sources and different places. Profit sharing and gain sharing I didn't talk about, but there you see in the Fortune 1000 companies, it's getting around half, 45%, and it's grown rapidly in 10 years. The all-employee stock ownership plan in the largest U.S. companies, it's now up to 11% of those. So whatever 11% is of 35, that's the number. In the electronics industry, where we think this is really the thing, you go to, I have students who will not accept the job in a company without an ownership stake. And I've talked to friends in other universities in the U.S., and that's very widespread. And people will look at you and they'll say, why are you working in a university? You've got no ownership stake. The Harvard University Pension Fund did very well. Harvard has its own fund of ownership of shares. They did extremely well, but it did not affect me one bit. The endowment of the university went up an extraordinary amount. The Yale endowment went down over the same period. And the highest paid employee at Harvard paid, you know, I don't know, 10 times what any our best professor, you know, our Nobel Prize winning guys paid 10 times more was the 32-year-old guy running that fund, the endowment fund. But this is, first this was only in the small companies, it was largely small firms. And the reason being, what you want to do in a small firm is say to the person, I can't pay what IBM pays. I can't give you the benefits. I'll give you some ownership stake. And if the firm happens to succeed, you're wealthy. And that's what a lot of young people want. Now it's stretched to where we're almost up to half of the large electronic firms because they find they can't compete. If I'm Intel and I offer you a job and you sit there and you say, what, I'm going to be a paid employee? What's my stake? Or else I'm going to join the little company down the block and we'll beat you out. And the ideal thing, I have two nephews who've just been through this process, is you work at a small company, and then one of my poor nephews, he now works for Bill Gates. And he said he's basically stopped working. He just answers Microsoft memos and things like this. But previously he'd been in a very innovative small company. And they were bought out. That was the best thing that could happen to them financially, though perhaps not in productive terms. And then we have ESOPs, employee stock ownership plans, own about 8% of equity in the U.S. So there's a substantial aspect of these kind of systems. And what we want to do is explore how well these systems do. Now, where's my next slide? Things falling on the... Well, you have in front of you slide four. When these fell on the floor, slide four seems to have disappeared. Here it is. Sure. Aren't we lucky? Oh, boy. And it's not just slide four. It's also slide 5A. We almost had a small disaster. And now what I want to do is, what are the questions we want to ask about this sharing aspect of the capitalism? And for some of them, we'll give you some answers. And for some of them, we don't have the empirical information at this point to answer. A lot of people think very strongly that linking the financial stake and participation raises productivity. That curve that I first gave you, the R curve that went up and down, it wasn't based solely on because economists like things that go up and down so we can have a maximum. I'm going to give you some evidence on that. There's a second issue, because what these things are doing is shifting some risk to workers. And there's a lot of concern with ESOPs, with stock options. Maybe all that Asda is doing, Asda pays a little bit less to its workers than, say, Tesco. Its workers will make off well if the Asda stock price goes up. But if, by chance, Asda goes through into the tank, suddenly those workers' options are worth zero, and they will have taken lower wages for a certain period of time with no benefit. There's a greater risk on them. That's an issue. Then there's a very important question, because one of the reasons why one may be favorable to this is something that Marty Weitzman pointed out, I don't know, 15 years ago, which is that if we have more variable compensation, we perhaps can save some employment in downturns. That if my wage falls through, as profits go down, not my formal wage, but the amount of money I take home goes down because my share of profits paid that way, and the profits are falling. Well, then in fact, there may be some employment flexibility. On the other hand, however, we know that executives don't like this. And if you've ever seen executive compensation, what they do is they rewrite all the options. So if the, I don't know how Asda will handle this, but if the share price of a major American company goes down, the executives march into the boardroom and say, our incentive is all gone. We're not going to do anything. And instead of the executive say, instead of the board saying, you're fired, you bum, they say, oh, let's rewrite the incentive. How much did the share price fall? Oh, gosh, you screwed up and it's half what it was. We'll rewrite the package. So now if you could just get it back up to what it was, you make millions. And that is it disturbs every economist who looks at this, because that is a really bad way to give an incentive to people, that you give them this special deal. And there is some move to change that. Then we want to know, the main concern when you give workers greater ownership stake or voting shares in a company, are they going to be short-termers? Are the workers going to be people who go to that point we had in the graph where capital wasn't getting enough? And we'll deal a bit with that. And then finally, which is the problem that interests me the most in some sense in this whole area, is can this reduce inequality? If you give share ownership more widely, or if it is more wide in the population, is this a tool to reduce the economic inequality in the society? Because I'll be honest, I'm not super interested in my nephew, whether he does or does not get to be a millionaire from his share ownership things, or even my students and so on and so forth. These are all very bright young people who are going to do well no matter what in the society. And so it's the all aspect of these stock ownership, stock option plans. It's moving the ownership down to the other employees. And there, I'll give you some information that we've just finished in the US. So that's our business. Now, yesterday I gave you three sorts of information to argue for the we care. I started off with surveys, I then moved to experiments, and then I moved to actual behavior of things. I'm going to follow the same strategy here. And first is some survey stuff. And I'll mix up the information a little bit more. This was a survey we did of American workers and managers. We asked the workers, who are participants in employee involvement committees. We said, and here we follow the strategy, not asking, remember yesterday, people exaggerated how good they were, or they were telling you they were better than the average person. So I didn't ask, did you make a suggestion? I said, gee, do workers make suggestions very often in your factory? And we asked them, or your workplace, and do managers take the suggestions seriously? So that was asked totally separately of managers. We divided into two groups of people, those who are involved in these involvement committees, which are set up to encourage workers to do this, and those who are not. And I just multiplied them together to get the chance of a useful suggestion. So it's a sort of a conditional probability thing. Here is making them very often, I'm taking as really making one. And taking the suggestion seriously by management is really making one. And you see, it accumulates to a huge, huge difference. If you talk with managers involved in these activities, they'll tell you this. I mean, this is the whole point of these committees, is to get the workers to produce more, so the company's more profitable, so I can have higher share price and therefore make myself more money. So that's one form of evidence. The second form of evidence I want to give is econometrics evidence. And these are, I call them meta-analyses and large studies, because they're a set of meta-studies who've looked at ESOPs, profit sharing, and various worker participation. You find them in the journals that are referenced at the bottom. And then there were a couple of large studies that were not part of the meta things, and I put those in too because I think they're great, valuable. They had a lot of companies. What you see, you go across here, and I won't go through the details, but they're there to go through the slide, is that ESOPs, employee stock ownership plans, seem to be positive. There was one study which a longitudinal trend means what they did was they compared the trend in the company before and after it had the ESOP, and they couldn't find an effect in this particular study. But the general result of these studies, all of these studies are designed the following way. You take a company, you get its record before it was employee owned, after it was employee owned, and you compare it to some comparable company. The one that my friends who do this love, and which we have an expert here who knows a little bit about that, is United Airlines. United Airlines is today the largest truly employee-owned company in the world. And various other airlines, and you're looking, and the airline pilots groups are looking at that as a reasonable model. That's pretty successful. Profit-sharing studies, I think, in general, show a little more positive. And I would anticipate that might be the case because a chunk of the profit sharing is more localized. And the more localized you do, the more you're likely to get an incentive effect. And then there are various things, what they call worker participation in decisions of different kinds. And here, in one case, they didn't even give us estimates. They just gave counts of how many T coefficients were positive and how many were significant and greater than 2. I read all of this, and I think most people who look at this literature, and you could look for yourself, say it certainly is that there's a greater than equal to 0 effect. There is some positive effect. It's not immense, maybe 2%, 3%. That's the order of magnitude. Now, on 6, I'll give you my own estimates of this. These are of the employee involvement committees, which I've studied. I've not studied the ESOPs. This is the same design. We have a set of companies, 211 companies, although one of them says 217. That's because employment was missing for 6 companies. And so this is our production function, standard production function, log sales, log employment, log assets. You'll notice it adds up to a perfect Cobb-Douglas. It comes to the coefficient of 1. And it's done, again, we have the year they put in the program. We have a time series. So we're identifying the effect of an employee involvement program by looking, each regression has company dummies in or firm dummies in. So it's all living off a before, after design compared to other companies. That's an effect of 1.5%. Not immense. Statistically significant. If you look at the sales figure, which I'd like to focus on next, it's about 10%. So what looks is going on is that the companies that had these programs, the workers were more productive. In fact, employment conditional on assets actually fell, but employment actually grew, which means these companies were making more investments in general. They're more productive, and they're growing and making more investments, and they are getting a savings on labor. That's what the whole plan is. Let's get your flavor. It fits exactly, I would say, in the same range of some of the other studies, a little bit smaller than some of them did. So one's reading of the sharing in decision making is that it's probably productive to a certain extent, and it is certainly not destructive. Great fear in this area has always been, you know, the workers. What do they say in the zoos? Don't let the animals run the zoo. So, gosh, let the workers run the company in some sense. Well, it turns out the workers, when they run the company, are pretty careful for the following reason. A lot of the workers in a lot of these companies, it's very clear in the airline pilots, their entire work life is tied up with that firm. They have specific human capital attached to that firm. The short-termers are not the workers. The short-termers are me with my pension fund. And if the professor's pension fund decides to sell United Airlines, I won't even know. I mean, I assume I could find out, but I wouldn't even bother finding out. They make some decisions, and hopefully the pension guy makes the right decision for optimizing my income. I'm the short-termer. I can get out instantly. Nowadays, I can just click it on some. I can actually click it on, presumably, on the web, and ding, oh, there, it's all, the transaction is completed. The worker in this place, all of his skills are tied with this company. He knows all the things about it. He is the longer-term character. And if you do a careful analysis of the incentives facing the workers, it turns out some workers may want to push short-term, but some workers, their skills are so complementary to what the firm is doing that they indeed will be the long-term people who will be more concerned about the future of the firm. Not always. It always depends on the company and the situation. Now, I said the key that I was concerned with was, does employee ownership change inequality or wealth? And we commissioned last year a study that was done in the state of Washington, D.C., because the gentleman and woman who did the study were employees of the state of Washington, and therefore could get access to all kinds of semi-confidential state documents. And they were able to match various records of the firms together. And they were hoping to find that the companies that were employee-owned had greater equality of pay. The answer, ESOP all firms, no ESOP. There's a matched firm design. No. This is not statistically significant difference, but it's very clear. The employee-owned firms were paying the same inequality as the non-employee-owned firms. The wage rates were you couldn't discern. If they had a union, whichever group had, you had a big decline in earnings inequality. So it's very clear. These kind of shared mechanism is not doing what a trade union would do. But think now what a trade union does. Trade union is representing one group of workers in the plant against possibly the other group of workers, being the white collar or the non-union workers, and against the capital. ESOP, they own it. They should behave as optimally as they can, and which means hiring people at the going wage rate, behaving as a good capital enterprise. The big difference is the following. The asset wealth of workers. If you're in the employee stock ownership plan, you own some wealth. Namely, you own these shares. And the average in this particular study was about $33,000 that these people had the average person in share ownership in a company. And just think of them as normal workers. being paid the normal wages and so on. And the people in the no ESOP, they had some plans too, because there are all these pension plans and things that we have, other mechanisms. They had, my estimate was $21,000. The people in the article who did the study seemed to think it was $13,000. And they discounted some things and did some different weighting. But I want to give the most conservative possible thing. This would be a 50%, 11 over 21, 50% increase in the wealth of the employees. And the major, a major issue in here was, gee, if they're getting this ownership and getting this employee stock, gee, they must be giving up something. Because on net, maybe there is, you know, there is, the company's just paying them the same compensation, it's just coming in a different way. So you think the company would have gotten rid of some other retirement plans. The evidence is no. That when they did this, what happens is that the employee owners, in fact, are getting a capital gain. The United Airlines people have made off a fortune in their ESOP plan because the stock has gone way, way up, and they're very well to do. So to think of these things as a mechanism for reducing wage inequality does not seem to be, that just doesn't seem to hold. But to think of it as a way of sharing wealth, ownership, yes, that does seem to occur. And the people who must be the losers from this in some sense are the shareholders who, the people like me, the pension fund owners of the companies, or the outside owners. And there is, there you can go and you find figures on, like in Microsoft, which has a lot of the employee the stock options, how much dilution there is of the wealth of the person who buys the stock in the stock market. Now, presumably, or hopefully, the dilution is balanced off by the fact that these people have an incentive and produce more and so on and so forth. But nobody's shown that that's, in fact, a good deal. And maybe it isn't, I don't know. Okay. Well, now, the last thing I wanted to deal with is, do workers in the US and the UK, do they want a greater say in decisions? Because the whole idea of sharing is, yeah, I want to share in the ownership stake, or I want to share in the profits or the rewards. But the trade-off for that, for the firm to be efficient, is you have to take some stake in decisions. And the evidence here is pretty striking. This is an average across 8 areas. These are American workers. But there's been a British a study that shows very similar results for these things. 53% of the people say they want more say in various eight areas. It's an average. Are people satisfied with their decision-making power inside a company, depending on whether they are in one of these EI programs or not? You see, the difference is pretty striking. The EI people are pretty satisfied. They are having some decision-making thing. Whereas the people who are not participating are not satisfied. But even the EI people tell you they want more say in the decisions. When we ask the people, well, why do you want this? What's the point? The answer they gave was something like this. The management doesn't know what they're doing. We could do much better if we made more decisions. And this is one of my favorite graphs. We asked them, do you think your management knows the business? Yeah, most people give, this is a school grade, A, D to F. We had a bunch of other variables, questions we asked them, we didn't put in here. What is the willingness to share power or authority by management? Well, we got a quarter of the workers saying, flunk. They say these guys know the business, they're knowledgeable managers, et cetera. And on our surveys, the workers kept repeatedly saying, we could make better decisions in various areas that would raise the value of the company. You can weight that evidence as you see fit in some sense. But it's very clear from workers feel that there is not enough decision-making power being allocated to workers. We'll go back to the curve we had at the beginning. If it's run by the managers, they're not going to allocate the optimal amount. It's exactly what that little up and down graph predicts. It says that workers should be sitting there saying, I know I can make decisions that will be more productive for this firm. And the management has given me some decision-making power, but not enough. But that's just is totally consistent, you see. Because if the management gives them more decision-making power, the management may indeed find that it has less profits to distribute to itself. Now, I'd like to talk a little bit about experiments in this area. I don't have a slide for that, because the one experiment that's been done, I don't feel too comfortable with it. It's done in a semi-artificial design. But I'll just say what it showed is precisely the kinds of things that we've been talking about. Oops, there goes another slide. And I want to just read the results from this experiment, which I don't feel sufficiently comfortable that I want to present it to you as the definity things. In our experiments, these are experiments set up with students in different sort of work teams. Subjects in worker-owned firms, doesn't mean that. It means students in artificially designed worker-owned sharing relationships exhibited higher productivity, perceived greater fairness in the pay they received, reported higher levels of involvement, had more positive evaluations of their supervisors, and showed a greater propensity to interact and give aid to others in their group. And then the contrast group was a normal firm. And what they did in this experiment, they took some students, they put them in a corner here, and they said, you're all in this sharing thing, it's all employee-owned, you decide who your supervisors are going to be, make a plan, etc. And the other group, they took a group of people over here, and they appointed this lady to be the boss, and they told her, look, the more you can get out of those guys, you take home more money. And the experiment came out in the right direction for these analyses. But there's only one experiment, and it's set up in a way that I don't feel fully comfortable. But I just want to be clear, the experimental evidence is totally consistent with this. We just don't have enough at this point. And somebody has to design a more realistic-looking experiment than this particular one. It's done by some Canadians. I don't mean that the Canadians can't design, you know, good experiments. Everybody in the U.S. knows that we benefit from a Canadian brain drain. Smarter Canadians come to the United States. Well, they do, and there's a reason that they do, because it's economy of scale. If you're a very smart Canadian, and you can deal in a bigger society, we just by moving from Toronto to Boston or something, which is a trivial kind of a move, you'll do that. And you have a bigger market if you're a writer, and you have a bigger thing if you're a movie star, and you just go right through the list of things, and a small economy has a problem in that respect.
And a smaller dollar.
The dollar's gone totally to the pieces, yeah, we know that. Canadian economy has not done well over the last X years, so that's probably also added to the brain drain. It turns out the Americans who go to Canada, it's a very interesting migration pattern. So I wanted to conclude, because these shared capitalist institutions, they're growing rapidly. It's clear that the market is speaking and saying more sharing of finance, more sharing of decisions. But there's a lot of sort of different companies trying different things, a lot of experimentation, I think, out there. And sometimes I look at some of what the companies are doing, and I just don't understand at all. There's a company we're studying in California, which has got a lot of PhDs, a huge company. They have a 401k, they have an employee stock ownership, they have an all-employees stock option plan, and they have two or three profit-sharing plans. And I keep thinking, isn't this overkill? Can't you just design one thing that'll give the right incentives? I mean, I would be totally confused with all, if you're thinking your employees. But there's a possibility what these companies are trying to do is to say to you, hey, you're really a valuable guy in our shop. We want you to really feel loyalty to your firm, and we are setting up all kinds of incentives to convince you that that is what we want. And that may be indeed what Asda is doing, what Starbucks is doing. It's a commitment device, a way of telling the worker, yes, you really are They don't even call it. I don't know in ASDA what they call the people, but in Starbucks, you're not called an employee. That is a totally forbidden word. Employee and worker are totally out. You're an associate. And, you know, your first time you hear it, you say, oh, God, what a ripoff this is. But then it is a real effort to try to bring the people in, and they are paying some money as part of it. I mean, they're giving them some share, ownership in things. So maybe it works. I don't know. This is obviously not, though, the full answer to any distribution problems. And what I did was I put little slogans for different forms of dealing with distribution. So I don't want anyone to go away saying, ah, this is the answer to the world. Human capital investments, well, we think of that as leveling the playing field for everybody. The welfare state tax and spend policies, there is a certain element of which we think of this shared capitalist institutions as welfare state does the following. What it does is it takes money that people have made away from them, taxes them, and then spends it on poorer people, hopefully. I mean, it may spend it on the rich, too, in some ways. It provides some insurance. What's striking about Sweden and all the big welfare states, they have never seriously, there was one Swedish incident, looked at sharing the wealth rather than sharing the earning streams. And the truth is, the United States, with its laissez-faire, right-wingish policies, has probably got more sharing of the wealth through these systems than any other society. And you could think about it as possible substitution aspect here. Then the question of, should you, through the state, encourage these things? Do you offer tax breaks to them? A fairness requirement, in the US, that turned out to be extraordinarily important. Although some of the companies are trying to wiggle their way out of this. You cannot set up a 401k plan unless every worker is covered in a fair way. I would love to see the executives, fine, have your stock option plan, but all the workers in the company have to, proportionate to their wages or something, have to be equally, they should be equally represented in this. That's the reason why we have these huge pension plans that cover everybody, because we've told the executives, if you write the pension plan only for you, by the way, you're getting no tax cuts on this. You can't deduct it as a taxable expense, and that's important. And then my most radical idea, but which some US congressmen have at least thought about and discussed, is share ownership at birth. And that has very radical kind of connotation, but it basically says, look, the state promises you Social Security when you retire. Why not instead promise you that you have a proportion of the national wealth in the equity market when you're born? And that's a potential a change in the society. I don't think we're going to see that, as a matter of fact. But with the huge surplus in the U.S., you know, it becomes an interesting thought. Why not use that for to establish some sort of form of greater share ownership? Then we have the private market. Well, these companies, it's about a third, I said about 30% covered by this, are trying their best to make the workers more sharing in their enterprise because they think it is profitable. They will never go, as far as my analysis, as far as they should. And that's where, when workers own more shares, perhaps they could push it further along. Collective bargaining is still legitimate. You saw it's still a major part of this, because you saw that the wage, there was no reduction of wage differences in the employee stock ownership plans. Let me tell you, the pilots in United Airlines, Robert, you might know more than I do about this, but I don't think they've proposed taking wage cuts so the steward, the flight attendants who are lower paid can get a wage increase. And couldn't conceive of them doing that. Or so the ticket clerks get a wage increase. They're not going to do that. So you have some collective bargaining there. And then finally, we talked yesterday about private market charitable behavior. So in this sort of spectrum of things, we should see these shared capitalist institutions as one tool or weapon that can be used both to increase efficiency and to distribute income among the productive workforce. We're not, it's not taking care of the homeless, it's not taking care of the elderly, needy, etc. Though if, you know, if they had shares at birth, maybe they would be part of this process. But we seem to prefer than giving them some ownership to tax ourselves and then spend some money, or not spend the money, depending on how the views of this of the state are. But I think in the United States, had the welfare mothers been given shares rather than rely upon the generosity of the welfare system, they probably would be a lot better off, and they probably would have been just like some of my ex-left-wing colleagues, looking at the stock market and saying, wow, that's pretty good. But you have to, if you do that kind of a system, you have real problems of, will people just sell their shares immediately, and then you've just given a cash transfer, and that's not what you want to do. You want to have people have a wealth transfer, is ultimately what it is. Okay, thank you.